From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After the terrorist attacks, even late-night talk show hosts returned to the air in a somber mood. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with satirists about what kind of humor has seemed appropriate or funny after September 11th. First, we hear from Harry Shearer and listen back to a sketch from the latest edition of his public radio program, Le Show. We'll talk with Saturday Night Live's Will Ferrell, who does the impersonations of President Bush. And we'll be joined by Robert Siegel and Todd Hanson of the satirical newspaper The Onion, and they'll read some of their work. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews last night's special episode of The West Wing, which was written in response to the terrorist attacks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. A Russian plane traveling from Israel to Russia crashed into the Black Sea today, killing all 76 people on board. The BBC's James Rogers reports from Moscow.
The Sibir Airlines Tupolev 154 came down while flying from Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv to the Russian city of Novosibirsk. It was a weekly charter flight. The Russian Ministry of Emergency Situations says the depth of the water where the plane crashed is about 1,000 meters. The cause of the crash remains unclear, but the head of Russia's internal security service said that Armenian pilots in the area had seen the plane exploding in midair before it went down.
The BBC's James Rogers. The White House confirms a case of a man hospitalized with anthrax in Florida. Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson says it is an isolated case and apparently not a case of terrorism. He stresses officials have an adequate supply of drugs to combat the illness. He adds the man is believed to have acquired the disease through inhalation. Health officials say the disease is not contagious and there are no indications that anyone else has it. Planes are flying in and out of Ronald Reagan National Airport in Washington today for the first time since September 11th. It's the last airport in the country to reopen. NPR's Snigna Prakash reports.
Security experts were reluctant to reopen National. They're worried that planes taking off and landing at the airport are especially attractive hijacking targets because of National's proximity to Washington, D.C.'s landmarks. But local politicians lobbied hard, so the Bush administration agreed to resume flights under strict security. Inside the airport's terminals, there are U.S. Marshals and Virginia National Guardsmen with guns and holsters. There are bomb-sniffing dogs and random thorough searches of check-in baggage. Passengers are also subject to random searches of their person at the boarding gates. Even the food at airport restaurants is being X-rayed before it gets in. National will operate only 25% of its previously scheduled flights for the first 3 weeks. It'll ramp up to 60% of its schedule at that point. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
NATO is granting the U.S. open access to its airfields and seaports. The military alliance has also agreed to deploy ships and early warning radar planes as part of the war against terrorism. U.S. officials praised the gesture as a unique event in NATO's history. President Bush today announced hundreds of millions of dollars in aid for the people of Afghanistan. The president said it's a way of showing that while the United States opposes the Afghan Taliban regime, the nation remains friends with the Afghan people. The president told Labor Department employees today that terrorism has sent a shockwave through the economy and promised to extend unemployment benefits and provide other aid to laid-off workers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 63 points at 9060. The Nasdaq closed up 16 to finish at 1597. This is NPR News. Barry Bonds of the San Francisco Giants gets another chance tonight to set a new baseball record for the most home runs in a single season. But his time is running out. Bonds has 4 games left to hit the 2 home runs he needs to set the record, but opposing pitchers appear to be doing everything they can not to let him do it. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
When Barry Bonds hit his 69th home run of the season last Saturday, it seemed certain he'd tie and break the record of 70 set by Mark McGwire in 1998. But since then, pitchers have thrown very few balls over the plate for Bonds. Several have admitted they don't want to be remembered as the one who gave up the record-breaking hit. Last night in Houston, the Astros pitchers indeed seemed wary in Houston's 11-8 loss to San Francisco. In 5 at-bats, Bonds walked 3 times, as home-run-hungry Astros fans actually booed their own Houston pitchers. A television camera zeroed in on a sign Bonds' 2 young daughters held up that read, pitch to our daddy. Although fans were disappointed, Bonds did break one record, Babe Ruth's 1923 mark for most walks in a season. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
While Bonds is trying to break the single-season home run mark, San Diego's Ricky Henderson has broken baseball's career runs record. Henderson today crossed the plate for career run number 2,246. That breaks a mark held by Ty Cobb for the past 73 years. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon today criticized the United States for its peacemaking efforts in the Middle East. Sharon said he would not accept attempts to, quote, appease Arab states at Israel's expense. Sharon stopped just short of canceling a U.S.-backed ceasefire, but said Israeli security forces would do whatever is necessary to protect Israeli citizens. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Life 360, a new series that explores life's surprises. Premiering Friday night at 9, local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the opening of last week's Saturday Night Live, Lorne Michaels asked Rudy Giuliani, is it okay to be funny? It's a question a lot of comics have asked themselves. Today we'll talk with several satirists about going back to work after September 11th. Harry Shearer doesn't pull his punches, whether his subject is politics, media, or showbiz. You can hear his satirical sketches and commentary on his nationally broadcast public radio program, Le Show. He's a former Saturday Night Live writer and cast member and a co-creator and star of the film This is Spinal Tap. On The Simpsons, he's the voice of Mr. Burns, Smithers, Ned Flanders, and other characters. Harry Shearer lives in L.A., but on September 11th, he was in Australia. Here's a sketch from last week's edition of Le Show. As usual, Harry does the music and voices, including the voice of Larry King.
We're back, and just to remind you again, coming up on Tuesday, the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, and the great Vic Damone. Now, we've been closing our shows with a song, an inspirational moment or two, and today we welcome back in our Los Angeles studio the former lead singer of the hugely successful boy band Boys R Us, Dewey Gordon. Dewey, good to see you again. Last time you were here, you had a song about Elian Gonzalez.
That's right, Larry. Let Elian Stay was the tune. Mm-hmm. And while, of course, it didn't succeed in keeping young Elian Gonzalez in this country, it sure did succeed in moving a lot of units.
Yeah, well, you're here to sing a new song tonight, Dewey, mm-hmm. just being released as a single.
Yes, sir, Mr. King. It's called Where's Your Flag? Mm-hmm. You know, I feel very strongly that... As a former member of a very successful so-called boy band, a term, by the way, that I'm very proud of, that I have an obligation not only to help out the firefighters and the rescue workers in New York.
They're getting the proceeds of this record?
Better yet, Larry, they're getting 100,000 free copies of the record. Yeah. But I also have an obligation to... You know, to show the American people that Dewey Gordon is a serious artist with something serious to say, something that I hope... helps to heal old divisions as well as create some new ones.
Okay, we just got a minute left, Dewey.
Okay, well, I just want to say, Larry, that this song is straight from my heart. Not that every other song I've done hasn't been as well, but, you know.
Even more from the heart.
That's right. Yeah.
Dewey Gordon.
Shelves, they're stocked with goodies, but being in your store is such a drag, 'cause the red, white, and blue is nowhere in view. Hey, where's your flag? Yeah, your hotel, oh, so very charming. And you know, I really hate to nag, but there's gonna be hissing, old glory is missing. Hey, where's your flag? Where's your flag? It doesn't sit in your window. decal or a coaster. But before I buy tires or a toaster, where's your
a sketch from Harry Shearer's public radio program, Le Show. Harry, welcome back to Fresh Air. Many comics have felt kind of lost since September 11th.
Yeah.
Feeling like it's inappropriate to be funny, particularly when the whole nation is grieving. And then feeling lost that there's nothing to be funny about right now. What was it like for you to get back to work as a satirist?
Well, the first show I did was from Melbourne, Australia, and that was about the most challenging thing I've ever done, because when you're doing this kind of work, what's my zone of confidence is my feeling that I'm swimming in the same medium as my audience, and now all of a sudden being 12,000 miles away, having seen the TV, you know, having seen Dan Rather on the air and all of the rest, still I wasn't in the same emotional world as my audience, and it was the most difficult show I've done, just to try to figure out how am I going to pitch in a musical sense, not in a show business sense. How am I going to pitch this that's appropriate? So I basically decided to do the show. There was no prepared comedy in it, and I basically took all the show quote unquote elements out of it, and basically just talked for an hour. It was in the middle of the night in Melbourne, Australia, anyway, so it was basically like more of like a campfire talk with a friend than a show. And then the next week, I just got back on. You know, my first thought was George W. Bush, is doing, I think, certainly compared to the expectations of a lot of his detractors, a pretty amazing job now. And he must be sitting there thinking, this is great, and yet Rudy Giuliani is getting so much better press than I am. So I wrote a sketch about that, you know, and I thought there's no way around the fact that he's probably feeling that, and that's human comedy. There's nothing wrong with that. I had second thoughts about one joke that I put in there. He's having a telephone conversation with his dad. I do this series of 43 and 41 phone conversations, much like they do. And I had George W. Bush saying, early on, I've never been so determined and so focused since the fourth time I quit drinking. And I thought about that joke for a minute. And I thought, well, that is on the edge. But it made me laugh, and I thought, he might well say that. That's not, that might well be true, and it might well be what's in his mind. So I let it go, and I didn't receive a single complaint about it.
But it sounds like you're maybe sorry that you included it?
No, I'm just citing that as the most different from my normal mode of conduct is I actually second-guessed a joke.
Right, I guess that is different for you.
yeah.
I think a lot of comics are thinking of the president as being kind of off-limits now. They don't want to criticize our leadership at a time when our security is genuinely at stake. What are your thoughts
on
that?
Clearly, one might be approaching this in a slightly different manner. We've seen that the journalistic consortium, which was doing a very painstaking recount of the Florida vote, has decided not to make its results public at this time because they don't think it's appropriate to even open the door to questioning the president's legitimacy at this time. So, I'm way inside those boundaries. but this is a time when the basic role of humor and topical comedy becomes what Freud said it was, which is to laugh at what makes us scared.
So what are some of the things that make you scared that you've been laughing at?
Well, the idea that Jesse Jackson was going to inject himself into this situation again, and there was some talk about Mike Wallace wanting to go along with him. And, what I've been talking about a lot on the show is this mantra we've been hearing now, everything has changed. As a matter of fact, there's an L.A. radio station that uses that as their slogan now. Everything has changed. KFI Los Angeles. Of course, their call letters haven't changed. But so much hasn't changed. And we like to believe we live in a time when everything has changed. I said on my first broadcast back, people go to the Elvis Presley vigil at Graceland on the anniversary of his death, or they go to some ball game that has some special significance. And when you ask them why they go there, they always say, well, I wanted to be part of history. Well, now we know what it feels like to be part of history, and it's not the greatest thing in the world. But in terms of everything changing, a lot hasn't changed, and a lot doesn't change because we're human nature doesn't change. We like to believe it. We live in a country that, for I think both political and religious reasons, likes to believe that history comes to screeching halts. So part of, you know, my job is just to poke fun at the things that don't change. The Mike Wallace Jesse Jackson conversation that I had was basically about two ego-driven guys trying to very gently negotiate their way to figure out how they could do this thing and not, you know, go over the line. And I think there's a lot of that going on. So, you know, and one might find that scary or one might find that reassuring, but I definitely find that something to laugh at.
My guest is actor and satirist Harry Shearer. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor and satirist Harry Shearer. You can hear his political satire on his nationally broadcast public radio program, Le Show, and on his website, harryshearer.com. Now, I want to get back to President Bush. I mean, you have been, you've been very comfortable satirizing President Bush in the past. Are there things that you're not comfortable taking on now, areas in which you might still strongly disagree with him, but you feel like, well, now's not the time to do a sketch about that?
I don't know. Because I do the show by myself and I don't have meetings with myself, I haven't.
You don't have a policy yet.
Yeah, I haven't written myself a memo on this subject. It's the sort of thing where it only will occur to me when an idea occurs to me, and either I'll reject it out of hand because I think it's not right, or I won't. But I haven't had such an idea yet, so I don't know what it might be. I mean, to me, the line is really a very bright line. There's nothing funny and no humor to be found in the disaster itself, in the tragedy that affected so many lives. That's so far off limits, it's not even worth discussing. But, you know, as with, and this is a trivial comparison, but it serves to make the point. When one was making a great deal of fun of the circus that surrounded the O.J. Simpson trial, there was nothing funny about the crime that started the whole thing off. That was horrific and terrible, and nothing funny could be done about it. But as the thing wound on and we learned more about these characters and their very human foibles, to put it mildly, there was a great deal of fun to be had with that. And I feel the same way about this, you know. I go back to my experience with being on the air during the Gulf War, which is the closest analog to this in many ways. And when people's lives were on the line, I wasn't making fun of the strategic decisions and the troop movements and the battle orders that were being given, because that's serious stuff and that's, you know, national security, and you don't make fun of that, especially at that moment. But, the Pentagon's eagerness to release the videotape showing, you know, how smart the bombs were already smelled to me like show business at the time. And, of course, it turned out to be. In the same way that, you know, in the wake of this, it was obvious to me that banning curbside check-in was show business. It wasn't security. And I called it that. You know, there's a certain amount of security that we have in this country that really is show business. That basically they're just to make people feel good, but it serves no other function. And so, you know, there's something amusing to me about pointing out that even in the most serious circumstances, a lot of what we are presented with is just more show business. Like, we don't have enough of that.
White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer said something about having to be careful what we say.
And what we do. Watch what you say. Watch what you do. This was his response to the Bill Maher incident, and he prefaced it quite candidly, I thought, by saying he hadn't seen the transcript of Bill Maher's remarks yet. So without the proper amount of information at hand, Ari Fleischer felt no compunction about going ahead and saying, the message is, watch what you say, watch what you do, which I think is a little more disturbing than anything out of Bill Maher's mouth.
What did Bill Maher say?
Bill Maher had Dinesh D'Souza on his show, and Dinesh D'Souza said, you know, something to the effect of, and I don't have, I'm like Ari Fleischer, I don't have the transcript here, but I've read it. Dinesh D'Souza said something on the lines of, you know, it's a mistake to call these terrorists cowards. And Bill Maher picked up on that and said, yeah, you know, cowardly is dropping cruise missiles from 2,000 feet up, which is a point that was made, I think, days before by Susan Sontag in The New Yorker. But The New Yorker doesn't depend on Sears for ads. And a shock jock in Texas raised a ruckus. Can you believe this guy said American soldiers are cowards? And pretty soon we saw, as they were always asking us to, the softer side of Sears.
Did you ever wish that you could almost be like Bob Hope and feel like you're really, like, through your comedy, boosting the morale of the United States by entertaining the troops? do you know what I mean? Just feeling like, I'm sure Bob Hope was always able to feel that his comedy was really helping serve the war effort, that he was doing something really tangible.
Yeah, well, it also kept him away from home. You know, I must say, Terry, I've gotten, and it's only because you asked me that question will I indulge in this kind of self-serving response, but I've been really pretty moved by the email response that I've gotten since the shows have followed in the wake of the attacks, because there's been an emotional quality to the response. They've all been positive, but there's been an emotional quality to the response that says that some of availability of a voice that's not in lockstep with the media, the major mainstream media's sense of what's appropriate at the moment, which includes Dan Rather going on David Letterman and crying as he recites the third stanza of America the Beautiful, and saying in response to David Letterman's question, what's going on here? Dan's full response was, they hate us. You know, somebody who pokes a few holes at that, I think, I don't want to make, exaggerated claims for it, but people say that it serves some value to them. So, and you know, if it's still on Armed Forces Radio, maybe it serves some value for our men and women in uniform.
Harry, what media have you been watching?
All the cable news outlets, BBC News, both radio and television, the three major networks, NPR, reading some of the British papers, the Australian papers. You know, one thing that's really been interesting this period of time, and this will take some old-timers back, but if you're like me, your email inbox has almost been like a teach-in. There have been a remarkable number of email dispatches that I've gotten from people who have been in the Army in Afghanistan during the time that we were helping Osama bin Laden during his freedom fighter phase. Remember that? People who are experts in chemical and biological. You know, there has been an amazing amount of information flowing along with the Nostradamus predictions and all of the rest of the hoaxes.
Right.
So I've been, you know, sort of immersing myself in that.
Any impressions you want to share about what else it's like to be in Hollywood now? I know you're about to tape the Bob Patterson show, the mm-hmm. new Jason Alexander comedy.
Yeah.
What's the atmosphere like now?
Well, you know, on the surface, it seems pretty normal. We did a Simpsons yesterday, and it had the basically usual vibe to it. You know, there's a lot of sort of joking with a bit of fear underneath the surface about this security tighten-up that's going on at these studios. I think it's done to reassure people, but I think paradoxically it brings fear more into that place than it might otherwise be. You know, there's just this ambient fear level that's going around. I don't know if you know this story, but last week in Los Angeles, there was an evacuation of a subway station because a couple of policemen went, "What's that smell?" Which apparently, we don't know the answer to that question yet, but it apparently was some cleaning solvent or something. But that's the kind of mass hysteria that we're teetering on the brink of. And I dare say that no matter how sophisticated a terrorist apparatus is, they don't know that we have a subway in Los Angeles. So, you know, it would be so far down the list. So, you know, I think part of the job of humor at this point is to try to diffuse this potential for that kind of behavior, you know, because, you know, the mainstream journalism, I think, did a really good job in the first week or two, pretty good job, in the first week or two after the attacks. But now they're reverting, you know, they're reminding us that what they were doing before the attacks, the business they were in was the 10 things in your kitchen that could kill you, details at 5. That's the business they were in, and they're still in that business. They just have, you know, meatier stuff to play with. So, you know, to me, it's important to kind of make people laugh at some of this, because otherwise they're going to freak out.
Well, Harry, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry. My pleasure.
Harry Shearer's political satire can be heard on his public radio program, Le Show, and on his website, harryshearer.com. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From PBS, presenting Life 360, a new series that explores life's surprises, premiering Friday night at 9. Local times may vary. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lost Soldiers, a novel set in present-day Vietnam by James Webb, author of Fields of Fire. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Will Ferrell of Saturday Night Live on rethinking his impersonation of President Bush. Also, highlights of the last two editions of the satirical newspaper The Onion. We talk with editor Robert Siegel and writer Todd Hanson. And David Bianculli reviews last night's special episode of The West Wing about tensions in the White House after September 11th. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last week on this season's first new edition of Saturday Night Live, producer Lorne Michaels asked Rudy Giuliani if it's okay to be funny. After a somber opening, the cast returned to humorous sketches. but the sketches avoided the terrorist attacks and their aftermath. And Will Ferrell did not do his impersonation of President Bush. He says he plans to do a Bush sketch this weekend. We called Will Ferrell earlier today. Now, lots of the jokes when you do Bush have been about him being not very bright
right.
and very kind of frat boy. Are you going to think that's appropriate or inappropriate now?
Well, I mean, so much of our approach is in a way taking what the perception is and then turning it back around and you know, regurgitating it to the audience. Obviously, we don't think that is so much the perception anymore. So it'll probably change somewhat. I know the piece this week actually is more of a take charge Bush and kind of playing more off of that. So I mean, at least initially, that might be the new angle.
Has September 11th made you think differently about satire than you ever thought before, about what the function of it is, what the bounds of taste are?
Yeah, it really has. Last night was our read-through night, where we read through all the sketches that have been written, and there's the first cut, if you will, of what's going to be done. And usually a group of us go out and grab a bite to eat, and we ran into one of the writers on Conan O'Brien, because they're in the same building, and we kind of just had this shared discussion of checking in with each other, like, how are you guys doing, and back and forth, and pretty much the topic of conversation was how slowly kind of getting back to work, trying to kind of get back into the swing of things, and at times feeling like you're getting it back, like you're feeling like you're being able to come up with funny stuff, and yet at least at this point it's still kind of flavored with this thing of sitting at your computer saying to yourself, is this ultimately really that funny? Is anything still that funny? And that's been the hardest thing to kind of fight through.
Now, you're in the new movie Zoolander, which is a spy comedy.
Right.
It's set in New York, and there are skyline scenes,
uh-huh.
and the World Trade Center has been, I guess, digitally
uh-huh.
erased
right.
from the scenes. I assume it's digitally.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that? Do you think that was the right choice to take it out?
You know, I went and saw it last Sunday with an audience here in Manhattan, and I noticed those skyline shots, and Ben Stiller had in fact told me that he had to go back and kind of lift those out, and you know, at first my reaction was like, oh, of course, that's the right thing to do, and then I wondered as I watched it what would have been the reaction from the audience had those buildings been left in. Would it have been, you know, an audible gasp, or would it have been more of a homage to those, you know, tall skyscrapers?
Right. Are you performing at the Carnegie Hall Comedy Benefit Monday? And if so, what are you going to do?
Yes, I am. I'm still trying to think of that. Jerry Seinfeld was nice enough to call me to ask me to be the MC of the evening, and he pretty much, you know, prefaced it by saying you can be funny or you don't have to be or whatever. So I you know what, I'm kind of just leaving that up to the last minute in terms of what I'm gonna do or say. I'm not you know, I'm not a stand-up comic, so I don't usually get up there and do the hey, how's everyone doing type of shtick. So I'll probably think of a few things that I'll try. Otherwise, it's probably not my job so much to be hilarious as it is to just kind of greet people and say hello and get the show going. You know.
Any chance you'll do it in persona as President Bush?
No, well, I was trying to think if there was any Bush material I could do, but but probably not. I may try to sing at some point as Robert Goulet.
That's always good.
So that's always good.
That's always a good thing.
You can always go to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What song do you think would be appropriate?
What kind of fool am I? I don't know. That would be nice, maybe.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Gosh, thank you.
And good luck this weekend on Saturday Night Live, and
okay.
Good luck Monday.
Thanks, Terry.
Will Ferrell is a cast member of Saturday Night Live, and he co-stars in the new movie Zoolander. Coming up, the editor-in-chief and head writer of the satirical newspaper The Onion. This is Fresh Air. The satirical newspaper The Onion has put out two editions dealing with life after September 11th. Headlines have included, U.S. urges Bin Laden to form nation it can attack, American life turns into bad Jerry Bruckheimer movie, and President urges calm, restraint among nation's ballad singers. The Onion is published online at theonion.com. It's also sold at newsstands. Their pre-September 11th work is collected in a new book called Dispatches from the Tenth Circle. I spoke with editor-in-chief Robert Siegel and head writer Todd Hansen. Here's Siegel reading a news and brief item that he wrote.
The headline is, Bush Sr. apologizes to Sun for funding Bin Laden in 80s. Midland, Texas. Former President George Bush issued an apology to his son Monday for advocating the CIA's mid-80s funding of Osama bin Laden, who at the time was resisting the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Quote, I'm sorry, son, Bush told President George W. Bush. We thought it was a good idea at the time because he was part of a group fighting communism in Central Asia. We called them, quote, freedom fighters back then. I know it sounds weird. You sort of had to be there. Bush is still deliberating over whether to tell his son about the whole supporting Saddam Hussein against Iran thing.
What was it like for you at The Onion to get your bearings after the attack and to figure out how you wanted to respond as a publication?
Well, to be honest, it was almost impossible to do that. We made the decision immediately that we weren't going to go ahead and publish an issue that week. None of us as comedy writers had anything funny to say. I think many comedy writers have had the same response. Then in discussing what we should do, when we came back the following week, there were many, many hours of discussion that went into deciding what to do. And I think when it started, we were all sort of assuming that we would do material that was not related to the news, that was not topical, and that would be just something that wouldn't touch on it. I think most people have had that same reaction. That seems to be what most of the other comedy sources have done. However, even though that was our initial assumption, we then realized that the more we talked about it, it became more and more obvious that we wanted to make some sort of response because it seemed like any other material would be kind of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we were done with those discussions, we had arrived at the conclusion that we would do something to respond to the events of September 11th. So it was a scary situation to be in, but it seemed like it was the only thing we could do.
One of the targets of your satire in The Onion is the hijackers' beliefs. And I'd like you, Robert, to read Hijackers Surprised to Find Selves in Hell.
Okay. The hijackers who carried out the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon expressed confusion and surprise Monday to find themselves in the lowest plane of Nar, Islam's hell. Quote, I was promised I would spend eternity in paradise, being fed honeyed cakes by 67 virgins in a tree-lined garden, if only I would fly the airplane into one of the Twin Towers, said Mohammed Atta, one of the hijackers of American Airlines Flight 11, between attempts to vomit up the wasps, hornets, and live coals infesting his stomach. But instead, I'm being fed the boiling feces of traitors by malicious, laughing Ifrit. Is this to be my reward for destroying the enemies of my faith?
Robert, what was the editing process for that? Maybe you could tell us who came up with it and, you know, when it passed your desk. Were you comfortable with it right away? Was there any considerations you had before publishing it?
Well, the idea was mine, so I was comfortable with it. I looked at it as one of the rare opportunities in this whole thing to actually take a traditional nasty onion style shot at someone. I didn't expect that we'd be flooded. I didn't think our switchboards would be flooded by people outraged that we were
showing disrespect to the hijackers.
That we were fictionally torturing the hijackers. It seemed like a great opportunity to do our more traditional the type of humor, one of the types of humor we do, but the type of humor that we felt like we could not do in this issue. So I felt pretty good about it, and I felt like it was, I wanted a broad range of things in this issue, of styles of humor and broad range of subjects to try to capture the whole thing. And this was, there were a lot of very sentimental articles in the issue, and this was one where it was sort of meant to be a crowd pleaser, in that it was, you know, the kind of thing that people could sort of cheer is the wrong word, but, you know.
It was a cathartic moment, I think, for us to just deal with rage.
Robert, another piece I'd like to ask you to read, and this one is headlined, Dinty Moore Breaks Long Silence on Terrorism with Full Page Ad. I think this is one you came up with.
Yeah.
Tell us about the inspiration for it, and then maybe read the piece for us.
The inspiration is pretty simple. It's just even still, every day since the attacks, you've seen full page ads in USA Today, in the New York Times, from every single company in America expressing their sympathy and support for the victims of this tragedy, and speaking out against terrorism, condemning the attacks, and in some cases, I mean, we're not really, I mean, are we as a nation really wondering how, you know, a particular company really feels about these texts? I would assume that everyone feels sympathy and support for the victims and condemns terrorism. Dinty Moore Breaks Long Silence on Terrorism with Full Page Ad. New York. Nearly 2 weeks after the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, the makers of Dinty Moore Beef Stew finally weighed in on the tragedy Monday with a full page ad in USA Today. Quote, "We at Dinty Moore extend our deepest sympathies to all who have been affected by the terrible events of September 11th, 2001, read the ad, which pictured a can of Dinty Moore beef stew at the bottom of the page. The entire Dinty Moore family is outraged by this heinous crime and stand firmly behind our leaders. Dinty Moore joins Kenoki Heating and Cooling and Tri-State Jacuzzi in condemning terrorism." You know, and it's sort of it's along the same lines as, Rosie O'Donnell donating $1 million and then making sure, you know, and then sending out a big press release announcing that she has donated $1 million. I mean, if you want to donate $1 million, donate $1 million, but you don't need to, you don't need to take credit for it and show the world how good, you know, how, what a good person you are. And so it just feels like they're taking advantage to some extent. So.
But I also think that that part of the humor in the piece that Rob just read is not so much attacking the hypocrisy of Dinty Moore, the fictionalized version of Dinty Moore in that story.
And we have nothing against Dinty Moore specifically.
Yeah, as it is also just reflecting the sense of hope, of helplessness that everybody feels, you know, because you don't know what to do. So you take out an ad and, like, "We, the makers of Dinty Moore Beef Stew, condemn terrorism." It's like, well, it's kind of a futile gesture, but I think everyone can relate to it. It's not necessarily an unsympathetic thing either, because I think everyone can relate to that feeling of, like, well, I don't know what to do, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Robert, I'm wondering about some of the ideas that you rejected, because you thought either that the tone was wrong, or it was inappropriate in some way, that you found it offensive in some way, or it just wasn't working.
Well, we rejected a lot. The headlines that really would have been wrongheaded and truly offensive, we didn't even come up with. I think we all, before we started brainstorming ideas, we talked about what our basic take on this should be, and we all really agreed that that we should, to some extent, sacrifice jokes for the larger message. So there weren't even really that many jokes pitched that were just way, way off base in terms of offensiveness or target. There were a lot that sort of towed the line that just to be absolutely sure we would cut. I don't know, Todd, can I, do you think I should give examples or just...
Well, it's hard to do
the,
that.
Like the quadrigon?
Yeah, well, all right, I'll say one that almost got on was the intent behind the joke was, again, to be something to reflect the way everyone felt so helpless. And the headline was, America Stronger Than Ever, Say Quadrigon Officials. And...
Oh gosh! Right.
And, instead of the Pentagon.
Yeah, instead of the Pentagon. It was quadri- and we thought it was funny and sad, but then, as soon as we had actually written it up on the board to select it, we're like, no, we cannot use that because people are going to think we're having a laugh at the expense of the people in the Pentagon, which we would never ever want to do, and would never even think up.
Does more harm than good. So.
And then we realized, you know, even though that's not what we mean by the joke, we don't know if other people take it that way. And even still, you know, there are some people who have taken the jokes that we did do the wrong way. I mean, just because since it's satire, no one ever knows how sarcastic you're being or what you're being sarcastic about. So it's a very risky thing.
You have a new book called Dispatches from the Tenth Circle, The Best of the Onion. And this is the second collection of pieces from the Onion. And there's one piece in this book that, at least one piece that I noticed, that certainly relates to terrorism. And I'm curious how you feel about it now. The headline is, Terrorist Extremely Annoyed by Delayed Flight. The Dateline is Chicago. His flight from O'Hare to LaGuardia delayed more than 6 hours. Hamas militant and would-be suicide bomber Nidal Hanani vowed Friday never again to fly United Airlines. Quote, I do not have time for this, said Hanani, seated at a Burger King in Concourse C, a plastic explosives-filled duffel bag at his feet. My jihad against the West was supposed to be carried out shortly after takeoff at 8:35 this morning. It is now 2:50 p.m., how much longer must I sit around this airport like an idiot before God's will is done? How do you feel about that one now?
Well, it's something we definitely would not have run in a post September 11th issue, but I don't feel the need to apologize for it, seeing as it was written 2 years ago.
The question of appropriateness in satire always comes down to what the target of the satire is. In that case, the target of the satire is, I think,
the airlines.
Is all of the articles about
air travel,
about business travelers and how terribly inconvenienced they are.
Right.
And it's contrasting the sort of trite and mundane frustrations of, oh, I've been sitting in an airport for 3 hours, with, you know, the life and death, you know, horribleness of a suicide bomber. And I mean, it's not even really about terrorism as much as it's about just people complaining, business travelers complaining about airport inconvenience.
I wonder if you have any observations you want to share about how other comics and satirists who you've been paying attention to are dealing with this.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that when the White House press secretary says that Bill Maher should watch what he says, that there's a pretty blatant irony there in that, you know, they're saying this is a time when freedom is under attack and under threat, under, you know, there's a threat to our freedoms. So therefore, at this time, you know, watch what you say.
Let's tear up the Constitution.
I mean, we live in a free country, and if we want to defend our free country against those who hate our free country, then we should remember that Bill Maher has the right to say whatever he wants.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Siegel is the editor-in-chief of the satirical newspaper The Onion. Todd Hansen is the head writer. The Onion is published online at theonion.com. A new Best of the Onion book has been published called Dispatches from the Tenth Circle. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli on last night's special episode of The West Wing. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Last night, NBC's The West Wing presented a special episode written and produced with unusual speed in reaction to last month's terrorist attacks. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear.
Last night's episode of The West Wing ended with that classic 60s protest song by Buffalo Springfield. It was an appropriate choice, and not only because of the confusion, anger, and warning in the lyrics. Stephen Stills wrote that song and recorded it with his band only a few weeks after clashes between youngsters and the Los Angeles Police Department erupted into riots in 1966. It was a case of an artist feeling so deeply about what was happening around him that he wanted, maybe needed, to react instantly in the language and medium he knew best. Not too long afterward, another group in which he was a member, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, did the same thing. Within 3 weeks of the Kent State shootings in 1970, where 4 students were shot and killed by the National Guard, that influential rock group had written and recorded an angry song called Ohio. Aaron Sorkin, writer-producer of The West Wing, had the clout and platform at NBC to move with similar speed. He wanted to talk about terrorism, its roots and its impact, and came up with a method to do it. But he's a scriptwriter, not a songwriter. Instead of writing lyrics for a 3-minute song, Sorkin wrote a script for a 1-hour drama series and had his characters explain all the things Sorkin wanted to say. A lengthy preface delivered by the series actors as themselves rather than in character explained the special show's premise. It was a standalone episode, not part of the regular West Wing storyline or timeline. It imagined a time, in our near-distant future, when security lockdowns of the White House occurred on an almost weekly basis. Last night's show began with one such security breach, triggered just as Bradley Whitford as Josh is about to reluctantly address a group of bright young visiting high school students. The lockdown confines Josh and the students in the same room. Slowly, over the course of the hour, all the other West Wing characters, including Martin Sheen as the president, wander in to calm the students and take questions on terrorism. All the characters, that is, but John Spencer's Leo, who is conducting an impromptu and fairly hostile interrogation of a White House staffer who is of Middle Eastern descent. A recently arrested terrorist had named several colleagues, one of whom went by many aliases. One of those names was the same as that of the White House staffer, so Leo feared there was a mole and perhaps a potential assassin deep within the White House. Logistically, this very focused pair of plots allowed Sorkin to confine his action almost completely to 2 sets and to make the points he most wanted to make. With the interrogation scenes, where the worker turned out to be accused unjustly, there was the smell of a witch hunt and a warning about prejudice. And with the student scenes, Sorkin was able to import a classroom into the West Wing so that all the other staffers could take turns lecturing. But that was the problem with last night's show. It was, at bottom, close to an hour-long lecture. Ordinarily, I'd say that's great. There are millions of people, especially young people, for whom a dramatic summary of the issues of terrorism would be a service as well as an hour of thought-provoking entertainment. But anyone who watches The West Wing regularly is politically aware anyway. And if a young person doesn't care much about The West Wing, a special episode devoted to terrorism isn't likely to be a big draw. So the show last night, in a very literal sense, was preaching to the converted. And some of the preaching was very familiar, especially the parts, echoing a well-circulated letter on the internet, in which Afghanistan was compared to Poland, and the Taliban to the Nazis, and Islamic extremists to the Ku Klux Klan. Sorkin, in the past, has admitted to using things he read on the internet, and that certainly looks like it happened again here. That doesn't mean the show didn't have resonance. At the end, when Josh entertained one final question from a student, he answered with a response that was more emotional than political.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Do you favor the death penalty?
No.
But you think we should kill these people?
You don't have the choices in a war that you do in a jury room. But I wish you didn't have to. I think death is too simple.
What would you do instead?
I'd put them in a small cell and make them watch home movies of the birthdays and baptisms and weddings of every single person they killed over and over every day for the rest of their lives. And then they'd get punched in the mouth every night at bedtime. By a different person every night. There'd be a long list of volunteers, but it's all right. We'll wait. But listen, don't worry about all this right now. We got you covered. Worry about school. Worry about what you're going to tell your parents when you break curfew. You're going to meet guys. You're going to meet girls. Not so much you, friend. Learn things. Be good to each other. Read the newspapers. Go to the movies. Go to a party. Read a book. In the meantime, remember pluralism. You want to get these people? I mean, you really want to reach in and kill them where they live? Keep accepting more than one idea. Makes them absolutely crazy.
The important thing in this case, I think, isn't that last night's episode was one of the finest dramatic hours of The West Wing. It wasn't. The important thing is that Sorkin tried and had a place to do it. Think for a minute about how few places in primetime there are that could make room for such an attempt. Think of how few shows have any real relevance, and think of how few shows, week in and week out, say anything provocative or meaningful. So thank The West Wing for trying and for being there at all.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the new novel by Margaret Atwood, The Blind Assassin. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The postponed Emmy Awards ceremony will be held Sunday night. On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interviews with two nominees, Jane Kaczmarek of Malcolm in the Middle and Edie Falco of The Sopranos. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.